My name's Clary, and I'm a recovering addict. I never sat down to tell my story before, but this is nice. It's comfortable. So. And I'm sure I'll settle in here in a minute. I'm really glad to be here. I'm really grateful to have been asked to speak, and I'm grateful to see faces in here that, you know, that I know love me, and that I know no matter what I do up here today, what I say, if I cry the whole time, which is possible, throw up, anything else, it'll still be okay. That was just what I felt like doing the last couple days. No, I'm really glad to be here. Thank you. And I'm glad all you guys are here because I, you know, Narcotics Anonymous, without a doubt, saved my life. I did go through a period of my recovery where I did not realize to what extent Narcotics Anonymous was the foundation of everything else that happens in my life. And that was actually just before a relapse. I was fortunate to have made it back. So, you know, it's because we're all here. You know, every single person is here that I'm here. So I'll start at the beginning. I was born 39 years ago. Getting ready to hit the big 4-0 in May, which is, I don't mind, you know. I mean, I have a great life. I do not mind at all. So I was born to a, I guess you would say, an upper middle class family, and had a pretty upper middle class upbringing. My parents were together until I was in high school, and kind of had a, you know, in many ways, I don't know, Beaver Cleaver childhood. I mean, it was really, it was great in a lot of ways. Now, if we didn't have our dysfunction, I have not met anybody in these rooms yet whose family does not have dysfunction of some sort or another. I mean, there's all different levels. We all have all different things that we've gone through and that we work through, and thank God we have the steps and a blueprint to learn how to do that. And I will say that, you know, that was something I even struggled with when I got here. I never went to jail, never lost my license. I was never even arrested. I was still in college. On the outside, I had a lot of, you know, stuff, still positive things going on in my life when I got here. And there were times, our disease will use anything to tell us that we don't belong here. I know people have, you know, had the opposite extreme, and that was what my disease used to tell me. You don't belong here because you haven't been to jail. You haven't, you know, lost your license. I never injected. I never used drugs intravenously. And those were all things that my disease used to use. It has to be more creative now. But in the beginning, those things worked really well. And all they did was serve to attempt to separate me from anybody else in these rooms. So I love an expression that our disease, you know, can be cunning, baffling, and powerful. I really do like that expression. I borrowed it. So anyway, so, you know, my life was, I was given a lot growing up, and I don't mean just in financial terms. I mean, I was given the opportunity for a wonderful education. I was loved and taken care of and looked after in a lot of ways. And, you know, that still is with me. It still serves me. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful for that. And, you know, until I got here, I think in many, many ways, I took that. I know how much I took that for granted. I had no idea what a lot of the world lived like, what a lot of people lived like, what a lot of people went through. I was very, very sheltered growing up. Very sheltered. When I look back on it, it's almost comical. So I was exposed to a lot of things when I came into Narcotics Anonymous, a lot of different people, and it was very exciting. It was awesome. I loved it. I was like, here is this group of people that, you know, is like the most diverse group of people still to this day I've ever been around. There's nowhere else I can go and have this many different types of people and know that we all share this common thing. There's this bond, there's this tie. It's like all these people in this room I see in the hall, and there's you see them in the bathroom, it doesn't matter. And you look at each other, and we all know we're here at this NA convention, and that is it's just an amazing thing. And you know, you can go anywhere and go to an NA meeting and have that. I keep thinking I'm going to settle in, but it hasn't happened quite yet. So I grew up, as I was growing up, my first experience, my parents would give me little sips of beer. And they drank beer sort of socially. You know, there was some social drinking. There weren't big wild parties at my house. Looking back, I can see that my father definitely drank more than was, you know, a person who does not have a problem drinks. But of course, when you're a kid, you don't know that. I mean, your life is what your life is. You don't know what else is out there. So that's to you is normal. So that was normal to me. Didn't think a thing about being given a little sip of beer. We just wanted to be like the grown-ups. You know, whether or not I can say that started me off, I don't think I would ever say that. I don't think I'll ever know. I think I would have probably discovered it at some point anyway. So I don't know how much it matters. I will tell you that I will not be giving my 4-year-old daughter little sips of beer. that much I do know, even when she's 10 or 12. But, you know, we were younger. But when I was probably 13, you know, I can always remember, like so many of us talk about, I can always remember feeling so incredibly insecure. And it wasn't like, you know, I wasn't funny looking. I wasn't, you know, it had nothing to do with anything on the outside. It was absolutely and completely that hole that we walk around with, that we try to fill up with anything we can get our hands on. That's what it was. And I had that from the time I was a very little child. So, you know, whether I was born with it, whether I picked it up when I was really little, I have no idea. Again, it's not one of those things that even, I don't even see it as important. But I do believe I've had this disease really probably since I was born. But so I can always remember that feeling. I can remember episodes when I was 5 years old. I can remember, you know, pitching a fit because, and I wasn't one of those pitch a fit kind of kids, but it was that's why it stood out so much. The little friend down the street had been invited to go play to the other little friends down the street house, and I wasn't invited. I mean, it destroyed me. It just destroyed me. I did not have that sense of self, that sense of peace. What I now is now, you know, God that I have inside of me. It's a higher power. It's a place in myself I have that I can refer to now. I never had that. I had a big gaping hole. So that had been there for a long time. I was an overachiever. That helped me fill it up. I always made great grades. I excelled at sports. I was an outstanding tennis player. As a matter of fact, I was a talented dancer and did classical ballet, and I had the lead. There was this big production, and I had actually beat out, I had won the lead in this dance production over the owner of the dance studio in town's daughter. It was a very big deal. We had rehearsals 5 days a week, and that was when I got my first true addiction. I fell in love. It was my first love. And I was 13 at the time, and he was 14. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time that I made a choice that continued to be a pattern for me of my addiction for the rest of my life. So here I am for the rest of my addiction. Here I am with this incredible opportunity. I've worked very hard for it for many years. And I fell in love with this boyfriend, and I dropped out of the play 3 weeks before it was going to go. And I continued throughout my life to do that, to give up everything for whatever the one thing was that I thought was going to fix me. It also happened to be that same boyfriend that that introduced me to alcohol and drugs. And really, it was off and running from there. The very first time that I ever drank, I was sitting on a beach. You know, drank as, you know, quote unquote adult at 14, but you know, I wasn't being given a sip of beer at 8 years old by my parents. But that first time I drank a 6-pack, I threw up. And that to me was what happened when you drank. I mean, that was just the way it was. And through high school, it just continued to progress that way. I inevitably sought out the wildest crowd at my private school, which, you know, is which is a little different than some crowds I ran across later on, but anyway, at the time. And, you know, one thing about that was we had, you know, we had the extra money to get into a lot of trouble, you know, and we did, you know, for as much as I guess that crowd was. But I inevitably sought out the group of people that was using the heaviest, because then I didn't stand out so much, because I always stood out with my using, and I was always aware of it. I mean, I was really always aware of it. It wasn't I did have those periods of time where it was cool, you know, we could play quarters, and, you know, I could hang with the guys, and, you know, there was a little period of time where it was cool, but it wasn't. There was always this little undercurrent, this little voice in my head that was like, man, this is just, you're not using like these other people are using, even the people that were using really heavily. And now there were a couple, but it's funny because my high school class was 29 people, really small, and five of us have been through treatment, so that's like, that's a really high percentage. It's like, but those were the people that I used with, so it's not surprising. I just happened to be the first one. I was the first one, so got into, you know, different drugs that continued to progress, and the fun became less and less and less, and the necessity continued to grow. I mean, the idea of having a good time with me without using was not something that I ever even considered since the first time that I used. That was to me what I equated with fun. It was so warped. It was so warped, but that is because my disease ruled my life from the first time that I put something in. So, you know, I put it in, and then it was the disease that was controlling and that was ruling everything that I did. When I look back, I really don't know how I was able to maintain as well as I did, except that I happen to believe that was part of my, you know, that was part of my addiction as well. It was part of my denial. It was part of, if I can keep my grades up, it must not be as bad as it seems. And I definitely used that. And it was another way, I think, too, that I did try to get that sense that I was okay inside. I never felt okay. I never felt okay. And I know you guys have felt that. I mean, I've heard it in meetings for so many years. I've heard it so many times that it's, you just never felt okay. I now at least have, it's not that I don't have that voice that tells me I'm not okay. That hasn't gone away. It's still there. It's not as strong. It's not as loud. The difference is I don't necessarily believe it all the time. There are times that I do, but there are a whole lot of times that I don't. And there are also people like you guys that I can say it to. You know, y'all have taught me that. Y'all have taught me to share what is inside my head. And that is so valuable. To be able to, I say it in meetings all the time, to be able to walk into an NA meeting and say, this is what is going on with me. This is the crazy stuff in my head. Or this is the crazy stuff that I did today or last night or whatever it is. And I am stuck, and I am in pain, and I am in fear, and I do not know what to do. Someone may or may not give me the answer I'm looking for, but most of the times I get what I get, even the power just from sharing that. And a lot of times the answer I'm looking for is not the one I need to hear anyway. But the power of in sharing that alone in front of a group of people is, I have never found anything like it. You know, I have friends, I have relationships outside of these rooms now. I didn't for a very, very long time. And I do have some relationships outside of these rooms now, aside from just with my family, my belly button family. And that just, when I look at that, when I look at those relationships, and then I look at the level of honesty and openness that we practice on a day-to-day basis in these rooms, I tell you what, I feel like we're the luckiest people on the planet. I mean, I just, there's not ever one part of me that thinks of all the life. Well, I won't say, you know, yeah, sometimes I think of either like what I missed or, But it's so worth it. I would not do it any other way. Whatever it took to get me here and to have the life that I have and to have Narcotics Anonymous and to have discovered the 12 steps is absolutely 100% worth it. And I would do it. I would do it over and over. I mean, it's just the biggest gift I have ever been given. So I value that, that openness, that honesty, and that safety, because that's what it is. It's a safety that we can come in these rooms and we can be who we are. We can be real, and we're going to be loved, and we're going to be supported, and somebody's going to say, keep coming back, and nobody's going to, and people may judge us, you know. It's not like I'm going to say I don't ever judge people. I do. I'm human, but, you know, I might have the thoughts in my head, but I have never told somebody not to come back. I tell them, thank you for sharing. Thank you for being honest. I know how much I need that, how much I value that. And where I get in trouble is if I start thinking my judgment is wisdom. That's dangerous. That's really, really dangerous. But as long as I recognize it for what it is and go, hey, you're human, and let's not try to live in that. And remember that when we're not humble, we're humiliated, which I think we've all experienced that. And it's, again, something I really try to stay hyper aware of. You know, some of that fear is, you know, living in fear all the time of every little thing that happens, and fear of life and life on life's terms is no fun. But there is, you know, that healthy fear. And that's another thing that the steps in recovery have given me, is the ability to discern, you know, what is the healthy fear? What is that intuition? What is that voice that's saying to me, Clary, you know, you might want to think about this. You might want to listen. You know, you might want to look at what's going on. You know, that's different from that nonstop, manic, rambling disease voice in your head of paranoia. They're two different voices, but and it didn't happen when I got here. It took a lot of work. It took a whole lot of work. Step work, and what's given it to me more than anything is meditation, but it took a lot of work to be able to get to where I could discern between some of those voices and the ones that were coming from a place of what's best, you know, for Clary, coming from a higher place and coming from the disease place, the fear place. So, you know, that's a gift of self-knowledge and of just practicing and of just being aware. So my using through high school was pretty crazy, but I did still, you know, I graduated high school and I actually graduated with honors. I was a commended scholar. I got a scholarship to school. It was all, you know, kind of this odd, you know, the way, it was just one of the ways it's the way my recovery was. And I still, you can still hear it, that I still have this part of me that feels like I need to apologize for that. And that's old for me, you know, because the other thing is that all each of us has to give is who we are. It is the single most precious gift that we have on this planet. And it's the only true one that we have to give. And so if I apologize for who I am or what my path was or how I got here, I'm not sharing the only real thing that I have to give. So that is my path. And see, maybe there's somebody else who had a similar path who feels like they don't belong here. And then maybe that's a gift that I can say, you know what? You don't have to do, it doesn't have to be that experience. We have, every single one of us in here has a different experience and a different path to getting here. And so, you know, this is mine. I went to college. And it was just crazy. You know, you've, at least at home, someone noticed if I broke curfew. At least at home, I mean, I was expected to be there. I would get in trouble. And I still was not the type of kid that would just look at my mother, and certainly not my father, and if I got in trouble and say, F you. I mean, if I got grounded, you know, I'd stay in the house and then sneak out the window after they went to bed. I mean, you know, I was respectful. So. Whereas my youngest sister would get grounded and say, F you, what are you going to do to me? And walk out the door. I went out the window, but anyway. So there was, you know, there was still that, you know, some boundaries for me when I was at home. When I went off to college, there were none. I think it's different now. My stepdaughter went off to college. I mean, there are things that are different. Like, they tend to have, you know, male dorms and female dorms, and you know, not where I went to school. I mean, it was crazy. I look back on it and it's like, God, how does anybody ever survive that? And it's no wonder that, you know, whatever the huge percentages of, you know, kids that go off to these big universities, you know, their freshman year, you know, fail out of school. It's just no wonder. And fake IDs, you know, we had fake IDs, we made fake IDs, and you know, I mean, I can remember being there with the little microscope with my friends, and it's just insane. I mean, they were just ridiculous too. You'd look at them and the numbers, I mean, it was just a joke, but people didn't care. You know, they just wanted something that you had in your pocket. So I went down there and still again maintained the grades. I still did that, but I can remember, the other thing I've always been able to do throughout my addiction is I always attracted the best enablers. I mean, you know, I was born into a wonderful enabling family. And when I left, I had this college roommate who was as straight as an arrow, who came from a family of, she was one of 10 children, and she took care of every single one of them. Seriously, she took care of every single one of them. So there was only one of me. Now, granted, I think it was just as hard as the 10 she had been taking care of, keeping up with the one of me. But it was amazing, and it's amazing how that works, how we, you know, we attract. It's funny how that works. So we were the perfect pair, you know, Clary, the insane wild woman, and here was Geraldine running around. You know, I'd be in bed sick, and she would run my paper over to my professor for me and make up some excuse. Seriously, I mean, it was just funny. She would run my paper over and, oh, Clary, blah, blah, blah. You know, but the paper would still be decent. I don't know how I did that. I really don't. So, and I can just remember so many nights. And my drug use really escalated at that point. It was so much more accessible down there. There were so many more, you know, it's a university of 30,000 people. So, you know, there were a lot of people with a lot of drugs. And, again, I still had some extra money. And also when you're, you know, when you're like a girl, it's a lot easier to get drugs. I think a lot of us know that, you know. If you're a cute girl, people want to give you drugs. And I don't know why. I think they wanted something in return, but yeah, those weren't around back then. Thank goodness that stuff wasn't around. But so yeah, you know, and there weren't. It's not that there weren't times when there were plenty of times where I couldn't get drugs, and I had a really interesting at the time. I thought it was the most screwed up thing. When I look back on it, it was just my higher power knocking on my door, just saying, hey, do you get it? You know, I can remember calling up this guy who I tended to buy drugs from a lot, and he would not sell them to me because he was worried about me. So this was a drug dealer with a conscience. Which, you know, hey, to me, that was a higher power. Now, I didn't listen. I just went and found another drug dealer. But, you know, for a drug dealer to do that, to say, you know, I'm concerned about you, I think you have a problem, you know, this was kind of the fun party guy, frat boy drug dealer. And here was this girl who so clearly was not able to use, even in that way in a college type of scene where people are using pretty heavily. I still stood out even then. You know, so that's pretty, that in other circumstances might have been a wake-up call. It wasn't for me. It just made me more diligent. But then, you know, nobody has willpower like an addict. I mean, you always hear the story of, you know, traipsing through the snow in the middle of the blizzard, you know, 8 miles and whatever it is, you know, to get our drugs. And, I mean, I didn't think anything driving 2 states. I didn't think anything about it. Get in the car on a road trip. It just was like, hey, you know, didn't give it a thought. So that year was, you know, was interesting. And all along throughout this, drugs and relationships were the two ways that my disease really manifested myself. And, you know, I look back on the relationship part of it, and I never got into a relationship where I did not genuinely want to feel worthwhile and loved. You know, I was so naive and so idealistic, and I still was when I got to these rooms, and it's still in my nature very much. And again, it's one of my greatest strengths, and it's also one of my greatest weaknesses. I think a lot of that works as a double-edged sword for a lot of us. But, you know, it's always still trying to feel like I was worthwhile, like I was an okay, decent person. No matter how much I achieved, how good my grades are, you know, were, you know, whatever it was, how good of an athlete, and I stood out in a lot of areas. I still felt so much less than everybody else around me. I didn't know then what I know now, which is that I had always compared my insides to everybody else's outsides. But I did not know that at the time. I looked at you, and you looked confident and accomplished and funny and sure of yourself, and I believed that that is truly the way you felt on the inside. You know, to learn that here, for you guys to have taught me that, just that one thing about comparing your insides to other people's outsides, that is a gift of just tremendous proportion that I remember and think about all the time. It's so funny. It just came up, I think, last week. I called Horace to check and double check on the time, and I said something about, you know, I think he asked me if I was nervous, or might have said, you know, I was. And truly, I have not let myself think about this. Because I would start to get really nervous. I mean, I really would start to feel like I was going to throw up, and I made some joke, and he started to say, oh, but you're one of the, and I was like, no, I'm not. Really, I'm not. You know, we're all just, you know, that's the comparing my outsides to your insides, you know, and I've done that. I have done it with people in this room. I have put them on a pedestal, and they fall, not because they fall, but because they're human, like we all are human. And I put them on the pedestal in the first place. And I have put people on a pedestal that do not want to be there. I've also put people on a pedestal that absolutely thrive being on a pedestal. And then I end up wanting to knock them off. But you usually don't have to do that either. They usually topple. But and I've had it done with me. I'm not saying this doesn't work both ways. I have gotten now to where I am so good, that discernment quality again comes in, and I can really tell much better when somebody might, you know, whether it's a sponsee or whatever it is, might have that glaze, you know, about glaze in their eyes or something, and I immediately do whatever I can to, because I don't want to take that on me, because my disease will latch onto that and use it to kill me. That's what my disease does. And not to mention that it doesn't serve anyone else. You know, I have been through that. I had a relationship. I would have to say, you know, it's hard to be, you know, you try to quantify or qualify or whatever things. But I'll just put it this way. One of the most, it's definitely the sickest relationship I've ever been in recovery. And one of the sickest relationships I've ever been in my entire life was with a sponsor in these rooms. And, you know, sponsorship is an incredibly important thing. I value it on both ends, as a sponsor and as a sponsee. The sponsor I have now has been my sponsor for probably 9 years. And can't see any reason why, you know, one day at a time that wouldn't continue for 9 more. You know, so I've had incredible relationships with that. But, you know, it is not we are all, you know, human beings. We all have different areas of our disease. And the other thing is that, at least my experience, and I mean, I would imagine it's similar for a lot of people, you know, I can continuously work my program the whole time. But I'm only working typically on a couple of things at a time. So I might have tremendous recovery in, you know, these few areas of my life. And there might be another area of my life, like, say, driving for me, where, you know, I can still act like a maniac on cocaine. I was recently very humbled with that. And it's not, we laugh about it and all, but it's scary is what it is. It, to me, it's very scary. It's almost like this little pocket, because I'm so good. I have this friend, I love the analogy, that game where the little heads pop up and you do it with the hammer. I love the analogy of that as our disease. You know, you pop 3 down and one pops over here and you go that and you're popping over here. I just think it's just the most, I love that analogy. So, you know, I've been working for a long time, so my disease doesn't have a lot of places it can pop up. So a lot of times it'll have a little outlet, and I mean it'll just go full steam ahead in whatever that is. So I have to remember that with, that's probably good for the recording too. I have to remember that with other people in the rooms, you know, all of us, you know, we all have our areas where this area, you know, you hear somebody talk or this whatever, and they've done a ton of work, and just because they haven't gotten yet to this particular area or I haven't gotten yet to this particular area does not invalidate all the other work that I've done. But it also makes me incredibly human and makes me thank God that this is a process and know that, you know, one day at a time, hopefully for the rest of my life, I can continue to do this and continue to learn and to continue to grow and to practice steps. And, you know, the steps are just my roadmap. I mean, you know, they talk about the steps being our tools, and that's what they are. I did not, you know, I had, in a lot of ways, I had a really good childhood. I was, you know, taught a lot of things, but I was not taught, and I couldn't have been taught because, you know, my mother didn't know how to teach me. She couldn't possibly teach me something that she didn't have to give. And, you know, I'm able to experience moments of real compassion for my parents. You know, I think I've been through a lot of hatred and blame and, you know, you screwed me up and, you know, whatever it is. And I'm really grateful that I don't live in that anymore. That is a painful, painful place to be. Blaming anyone for what is going on in my life is a painful place to live. And I'm very grateful that I don't have that. But see, the steps are just this... they're this basic roadmap. They're the most basic tools, very simple. Does not mean they're easy to do, but they're so simple, and they're so true, and they're so pure. And to have that, to have been taught that, to have somewhere that I can come when I have tried everything else in my life, every other way to make my life manageable and was unable to do it, and to come in here and to go, hey, you know, your life isn't manageable. It really is not manageable. It's not that you can't do it. You can't do it. You know? And it's, and I forgot that for a while, too. I forgot for a while in recovery, and again, I ended up relapsing. Move on in my story. But so get out of my freshman year in college, crazy year, survived it somehow. I'm back home for the summer doing the, you know, my summers consisted of parties every night, all night. I mean, that's just what my summers consisted of. I think I was supposed to have a job, but it was never like enforced. I do remember one time I was waiting tables. This just is such a perfect example of the way our brains work. And so I waited tables at night, and I laid on the beach all day long, you know, and I'm sitting there with my friend, who's the biggest party girlfriend I can find anywhere around, the person who I stand out against the least. And I'm saying to her, you know, I have this waitress job. I'm probably going to make, like, you know, like $120 a night, and that's, you know, like, that's like, I can buy a gram a night. And I start, and I'm, this how I mean, that's my... you know, that's my reference. That's what I'm adding up, how many drugs I can buy sitting on the beach. You know, it's just crazy. That's the way our brains would work, just so all-consuming. And my brain can still work that way today with different things, you know, whether it's, oh, you know, I have enough to buy a $200 pair of blue jeans or whatever it is that I don't need that I think is going to give me a temporary fix. And I can obsess on. It's really funny. And who would have ever thought that blue jeans could ever cost $200? I just can't. I mean, I really, truly, hopefully most of us don't buy a lot of them, but I have a little weakness in that area. and shoes, but anyway, shoes and blue jeans. So I was home for the summer doing my typical really productive thing of parties all night. And I went to this one party, and we were supposed to get this particular drug that was my drug of choice, and we couldn't get it. They didn't have it, and we called everybody under the sun, and you know, my best friend was a guy that I was with who I'm still friends with today, amazingly enough. And we called everywhere, and there just wasn't any. And he goes, well, whatever, we'll just go to the party and drink. And I couldn't. I wanted to do that, but I couldn't, because I didn't know it at the time, but the obsession had already gone off. And so for an addict, when there's the obsession, there's the compulsion. And when we're practicing addicts, we don't know any other way. We can't just get the obsession and the compulsion and then not do it. But I didn't know, of course I didn't know what it was. I had no idea that was what was wrong with me. I just knew that I couldn't then go to this party and act like, oh, well, we didn't get any, we'll try tomorrow. And it scared me. It actually did scare me. There was enough awareness, enough of a part of Clary that wanted to live, enough of that little voice that I now, that loves me, that I can listen to much, much stronger. Something, God, I know now, you know, it was my higher power working in my life, enabled me in the midst of that. And I wasn't even in my hometown. I was spending the night over in, you know, 30 miles away, Spartanburg. I lived in Greenville. And the little voice said, you are in trouble. And I called my mother up on the phone, and I have to give my mother a lot of credit, with one exception, which was when I told her I was going to marry my current husband. Anytime there has been a very serious thing in my life, whereas she might drive me crazy and be petty as can be about all sorts of little day-to-day stuff, when it's rock bottom or whatever it is, boy, my mother would just drop everything, no judgment, boom, she was there for me. And I called her up on the phone and I said, I have a drug problem and I need help. And she didn't skip a beat. She said, okay, we'll get you help. And that was it. And she proceeded to take me around to all the different treatment centers and investigate them and which ones were the best ones. And we had the means to be able to do that, and I'm very grateful for that. There were a lot more good treatment centers then, though, in my opinion. I don't know. Treatment these days is really scary, in my opinion. It's really, really scary. And I know, because I ended up going back in many years later. But I went to treatment and for 30 days. And it was great. I mean, it really was great. You know, it was safe. It was, it was a great experience. That's where I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, I got it that NA was where recovery was. You know, when you're in a treatment center, it's really easy to, you know, you're so safe in there. But some part of me got that, like, I always wanted to be in, you know, real life recovery. And I knew it was NA. So I immediately started going to meetings and, you know, I mean, not, you know, the ones when I got treatment and the Little Red House, and some of you from around here will know where that was. And I still remember to this day seeing the man walking in there and seeing the man who I'm married to today. And it was one of those experiences where, you know, I had this sheltered childhood and, you know, he was like long hair and tattoos and Harley. And I was like, whoa, you know, it was the coolest thing. It was the coolest thing I had ever seen. There were several of them. And I was just thinking, I'd never seen people that looked like that in my life. And I was terrified and fascinated and knew that I was going to get to know them as soon as possible, which I did. And we were buddies. And I also got into a relationship right away. And, you know, none of us do that because we're not supposed to our first year. So got into a relationship right away and relapsed with that person. It was only, fortunately, a one-night thing. It scared me, and I came right back to the rooms. That relationship ended pretty quickly. So, and I stuck around. I was around, and NA was my life. It was everything. I was in meetings all the time. I never counted. I don't think I did 90 meetings in 90 days, but, I mean, it was real close. Everything I did, you know, who I lived with, who I hung out with, who what I did after meetings and between meetings, everything. You know, back then everybody left the meeting and went to get coffee and, you know, we went to Shoney's and, you know, we'd eat the little strawberry pie. It was so good, you know, and it was like 99 cents or something. It was crazy. It was really, you know, we would all do that. It was my whole life and it was great. And, you know, I worked at Pizza Hut and I delivered pizzas and my manager happened to be in recovery too. And, you know, it was just this magical time. And it was the foundation of my recovery, absolutely, and a very strong foundation. And had many, you know, a few wonderful years. And then when I had about a little over 3 years clean, I got into a relationship, and my heart got broken for really, I think, the first time in my life. And that's pretty disgusting, but it was true. My heart was busted wide open. This guy dumped me. I think it was like New Year's Day. I loved him. I wanted to marry him. He's a great guy. I mean, I still see him today. I saw him just last week, and it's if you could have told me that I would ever see this person and not feel like I was going to die, I would never have believed you. But I can see this person now, and I feel love, but not just love like I feel for everyone, you know, and that is recovery. I mean, that is true going through the process, letting go, and truly where you heal. You know, like it's a complete full circle, and what a gift. And you guys taught me how to do that. So what happened was my heart got busted wide open, no big story. And I was like, it hadn't happened to any of us. And my disease saw an incredible opportunity. I did not know that was what was going on at the time, but it saw an incredible opportunity for any chance it could take to again drive that wedge between me and you. And the voice in my head would say, it's too painful to go to meetings and see this person. It will hurt too much. I remember being at this convention, because it was actually New Year's Day, and you know, the convention's always right after that. So a few days later, and I remember being at the convention, and this person walked across the dance stage with this very, you know, beautiful girl that I knew, and they were hooking up. I mean, you know, it's not any, that's what was going on, and that's fine. I thought I was going to die. I mean, I thought there was no way to handle that much pain. You know, when you're using, you never feel that much pain, and you take the drugs out, and you work the steps, and you open your heart up, and you learn to take risks, and you let yourself get close to people, and you let them see the real you, not the picture you put out there, because when they reject that, no big deal. But you let them see the real you, and they reject it. And, you know, I didn't have the tools. Well, I did have the tools, but I did not use them. I used them to the best of my ability, but I didn't have the tools I needed, I guess, or chose not to use them. I'm not sure how to look at that, but I do know absolutely the choice I made. I made a choice, and this is absolutely where it was my responsibility, that I could not handle the pain of coming to meetings because I couldn't handle seeing him. That was the choice I made that led me to relapse. And it was a choice. I'm under no illusion that it was this person's fault or anything else. I absolutely 100% know that I chose that. Now, I didn't use for 6 months, and I still kept in touch with recovering people. I still have my sponsor. You know, my best friend was in recovery, and, you know, we did stuff together all the time, but I couldn't take that risk of seeing that person and feeling that pain. And that was all my disease needed to have the upper hand. That was it. I mean, that was it. So the way it also worked was very subtle. My disease chose to say to me, the voice in my head, you know, you were 19 when you got here, because I was young, and really your real problem was that particular drug. You know, that was your real problem. But, you know, drinking was never, you drank a lot, but it was never that out of control. And really, you know, you were young, and you could probably just handle a social drink. I don't think it would be a big deal, and that's how it started. Was I was going to socially drink. I'm not the first person to leave these rooms to go have a social drink, and I will not be the last. It wasn't 30 days, and I was blacking out, you know, in bottles of tequila, and then I drank. So I never would have thought you could drink like that. I mean, I never would have thought it. I had not spent a lot of time. And there's another fellowship, obviously, we all know about, and, you know, you hear stories in there, and I couldn't have imagined that I could be that. I really couldn't have, but I absolutely am capable of that. There's a huge gift in that. It's that, anyway, my relapse continued for 7 years, and it was We talk about the progression of this disease. It is so true. I could never have understood. It is terrifying how this disease progresses and how quickly. And I don't understand that. It's okay that I don't understand it, but how your disease progresses when you're not using, I don't get that. But it was like, my using was like I had not, like where I would have been had I kept on using that whole time. It's just frightening. I mean, just terrifying. Things I did, I would have never, ever thought I was capable of doing. Still, up until the very end, still throughout that 7 years, I went to graduate school. I had a very successful career with a large Fortune 50 company. I still had that overachiever part of me going on at the same parallel time, and I still tried to use it to convince myself, even as bad as I was, that I could still socially drink. The eve of my first wedding, I'm married to my second husband, but this is my first husband, and it was all the way it was supposed to be. You know, this guy's from the good family, like I'm from the good family, and you know, the long southern line of blah, 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 and you know, so it's the big to-do, the huge to-do wedding in Greenville and the whole, you know, mess, and it's the night before, and one of the groomsmen, who also happened to be my boss at the time, had that drug that I had such a hard time with all those years ago, and was passing it around, you know, happy occasion, you know, everybody's getting married, and blah, 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 and you know, and I said, wow, you know, I haven't done that drug in however many years. You know, that put me in, you know, treatment, and proceeded to just say, and he said, oh, maybe you shouldn't do it. And I said, oh, no, it'll be fine. And it wasn't fine. I did manage to get through that night and go to the wedding. I felt terrible, but there's so much high energy going on with something like that. You get through it. And my poor first husband, I mean, he had no idea what he was getting into. I mean, he didn't. I really, not that he didn't have his own issues. I mean, people are attracted for a reason. He happened to be an exercise addict, truly. I mean, he was a professional triathlete and you know, would train like 12 hours a day. I mean, the guy would ride a bike 100 miles a day, and then he would go run 12 miles, and then he'd go swim 2 miles. And that was like a normal day for him. That's not normal. Not normal. You know? But, so we were a great fit because he was never home. So he could go do his stuff, and then I could just use myself into oblivion, and it was this farce, really. And then, of course, he tried to save me again. I married a wonderful enabler, and he tried everything he could to save me, and he could not save me. And I ended up, and I still can't even remember. I guess I could look up records somehow. But I did try to commit suicide one night, and this was about probably a couple years before I finally got clean. I didn't know what else to do. I would try to go to meetings. I never came back to NA. I just need to say this, that it's not like I think, this is my home, and the reason I didn't come back to these rooms is because you guys knew me. So I still had the shame of the relapse, so I hid out in another fellowship. It was not that that fellowship was any less powerful recovery or anything like that. It's just the reason I was going there is why it didn't work, because I was still hiding there, if that makes sense. I walk in these rooms, and I see, you know, people that knew me. There was no more hiding. And I wasn't willing to do that yet. I hadn't quite reached that bottom, no matter how much despair I was in. Boy, you know, the first 10 minutes I was thinking, I am never going to be able to talk for this long. And now it's like almost over. And I have all this stuff to say. So I'm just on my relapse. But anyway. tried to commit suicide and was committed, and you know, all that stuff. And that's when I found out how much treatment centers had changed. I was looking for this 30-day set, you know, it was not the same. And then a year after that, you know, voluntarily, I thought, went to put myself in, and I had not used for like 2 days, but I was detoxing, and you know, could I have a safe place for a couple of days? And they said yes, and this is voluntary. Yeah, and this was the same place I had been like 10 years earlier, but it was so different, or more longer than that. Yes, it's voluntary. I can leave whenever I want. Yes. And then they locked me up, and I couldn't leave, and I could. It was insane, and it was scary. And I remember thinking, I was up there, and I was locked up, and I was with people that are how we get. You know, I mean, there are people with real mental problems, and we can create those mental problems with our disease. And I was up there, and I was like, man, I do not belong here. You know, but I did belong there, and that was really scary. And what happened was they had told me I could leave, and I said to them, you know, I'm rational. I had used for 3 days. You told me I could leave, and they weren't listening to me. It was like they were talking to, and I remember having this impulse. I was on the phone. I called my mother, and I was like, they're not listening to me. You know, get the lawyers, get the, you know. And I said, I'm going to pick up a chair, and I'm going to go insane. It was like being a caged animal. And some, again, that voice heard my mother when she said, if you do that, you will not get out.
Right.
You will not get out. And some part of me heard that and went, okay. And that was such a wake-up call for me about, man, this is not, that jails, institutions, and death thing, it is as real as it gets. It is absolutely, if you are not in recovery, it does not matter if I'm a debutante or went to private school or had a great childhood or anything else, I am absolutely not under any illusion that that is where I would end up. And that is an incredible gift. And I hope I never, ever, ever forget that. And when I hear, somebody was talking about this in a meeting the other night, about a saying they used to say a long time ago about sometimes you got to step over one every now and then, and it sounds so callous and so cold, and you know, people go out and they really do die. My one of the best friends I ever had in recovery, I love this guy so much. Not, I mean, we were friends. We were never in a relationship. We were roommates, and his name was George. I always love him, and you know, he died of this disease, it happens. All of us know people that have died. All of us do. It's not any big, you know, it happens. We are addicts and we have a deadly disease. And that still serves as an incredible gift to me to know, because that disease, my disease will still say to me, you're different. You know, look how good your life is now. Look what you are capable of. Look what you can do. Do you really think that you couldn't handle a glass of wine with your dinner? My disease will still say that, because I am capable of a lot today. I would never have thought I could do what I'm able to do in my life today as a result of being in recovery and working the steps and continuing to grow and learn. You know, I'm a parent by choice. I chose to become a parent, and it's being a conscious parent. Is the most amazing thing I have ever done in my life. And to think of ever doing that without this program, it terrifies me. So I ended up getting back in recovery, and I'm so lucky to be here. I'm really, really, really lucky, and my recovery has been, it's been amazing. It hasn't had anywhere near the drama it had the first time, and I'm really grateful for that. It hasn't been a series of relationships and one things after another. I mean, I got here, I knew, boy, this is life or death, and I'm not messing around. And I didn't want to mess around, and I don't. You know, my life is precious, my time is precious, and I value it, and I value my time and my energy, and I choose how I use it today. I'm very picky, and I don't mean that. I just mean that I really do choose. You know, I see those things. My life is a real gift, and it's precious to me, and I don't want to waste it, and I don't want to squander it. And meditation, I do want to say one thing about meditation. I was in recovery for a lot of years before I really practiced meditation, like it talks about in the 11th step. And working the steps, everything else, all of those things have changed my life. But I will say, this is just for me, that meditation is the single most powerful tool I've ever been given in my whole life. And that's a dramatic statement. And that is just for me. And it may just be for where I am in my life now, because you know how that changes. You know, you get up to a certain point and you're like, whoa, and you get to another point and you're like, whoa. And that's really, the meditation thing has really been working for me for, you know, a few years. And, you know, when I started out, I meditated, my goal was to meditate for 5 minutes. That was my goal. And I can remember 2 minutes going by and looking at the clock. And, I mean, I just remember the clock was right there, and I'd be like, God, it's only 3 minutes, you know, and, you know, squirming. And, I mean, I just can remember how hard it was, you know, even with years of recovery, to think that it's that hard to sit still for 5 minutes, you know, is really, it tells you a little bit about the nature of our disease. I mean, and it tells you about the angst that we tend to walk around with, you know, that whole whatever you want to call it that we're just trying to put something in there, you know, because when you sit there like that, you know, you can't be putting stuff in. But what happened was I just kept doing it. I remember somebody talking about it. I remember going up to him after a meeting. It was, anyway, the guy that I know that some of us know, and he was talking about it. He just sat in a room, and once he began to start to feel effects of it. But it took a long time, and I thought, well, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to keep doing it every single day. I'm just going to keep doing it. There's a lot of other things y'all told me to do that I couldn't have imagined how they could work. So I thought this is just one more thing. And I did it. I kept doing it day after day after day, and it got to where, you know, then I could go 10 minutes, and then I could go 20 minutes, and it continued to grow. But what happened was, what that gave me was a more consistent way. It was the easiest way I found. Not that I hadn't gotten glimpses and pieces of it, you know, like you can go sit on a mountaintop and get that feeling, or you can come to a really great NA meeting and get that feeling. I had had glimpses of it. But what it gave me was a means within my own control to be able to tap into that easily anytime I wanted. And that is a tremendous, tremendous gift. So now what I have is this, all I can call it is a new reference point that I never had in my life. It's this new kind of, it's a almost like a place, but it's this sense that this place I can get to of peace inside myself that I can take with me anywhere. And that is the only way, I guess, that I really... It's how I experience my happy, joyous, and free, is having that peace inside me. And I tell you, when I really, really, you know, as it's continued to progress, I notice it more and more. But I tell you, go shopping at Christmas time. It's a good way to assess where you are in that. Because I can still remember going shopping at Christmas time and standing in the mall and thinking, I'm going to stop. I even made a joke to one of my friends that I'd done it, which I hadn't, but I felt like stopping in the middle of the mall and just starting to scream. You know, just like a psycho person. Because I had no way to center myself in the midst of all of that chaos. And that is what meditation has given me. It's giving me a way to find that calm and that center and that higher power and that God that is within me. And I can get it anytime I want to. I'm doing a lot of, you know, stepped up some commitments in my life right now with work. And it's great. I feel ready to do it. But I do really notice I might have a particularly stressful few hours. And to have a tool like that where I can, sometimes it only takes a couple of minutes. Sometimes it might take 20. Sometimes it might take 40. But, you know, when you have that reference point, it's easier and easier, and I can step out, and I recognize now when I'm getting that manic, when I'm getting that out-of-control feeling, I can see it now in myself. And before, it would be I would have to go do something to fix it, and I quit using drugs, but there are plenty of other things we do. You know, we go shop, we go road rage, we go eat, there's lots of other things that we go do when we get that feeling, even though we don't use drugs anymore. And so... that has given me a tool to be able to go take 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever it is that I need, and recenter myself and come back to a place of where I'm feeling that peace inside of clarity. And that is an amazing, amazing thing to be able to tap into that. It's great. I mean, prayer is incredible too. I mean, I pray all through the day. I mean, I think a lot of us do. I shoot up little prayers all the time. You know, pray just to, you know, for God, knowledge of God's will for me, the power to carry that out. And the first time I was aware of what that meant. Somehow, I didn't have any problem with the third step, you know, turning my will and my life over. I mean, it was like, yeah, okay, I can do that. But there was some part, it was a long time before I worked the 11th step. I didn't even want to say really worked it, because I wouldn't work it at all, because I knew, some part of me knew that it was going to be life-changing. And I was scared of that because it was unknown. Now, having lived that way, I wouldn't do it any. It's the biggest gift. It's true freedom. It's true freedom. But I didn't know that. It was terror, is what it was. So you know, you guys taught me that. I learned it here. I learned it in Narcotics Anonymous. And you know, I don't know how to say thank you for that. You know, one way I say thank you is that when somebody asks me to come and tell my story, and I'm terrified to do it, that I do it anyway, because, you know, I try to do what I'm asked when I can do it. It's when, you know, somebody asks me for my phone number, and, you know, sometimes I'm real happy to put my name on that list, and sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I'm feeling overwhelmed and whatever it is, and so those are the ways that I try to say thank you. To the best of my ability. So thank you all for listening to me today and for asking me to be here and for doing what you do and for staying clean and being here for me. Thanks.